Anyone? Anyone else? Nope. Okay. So as a whole, we have an hour-long call today, I think. And I think it would be really helpful. One of the things that people ask about when we did a focus group in Orlando at the end of January was it would be helpful to get an overview of recovery orientation this year. My recollection was that people in the room had different levels of exposure and understanding, and thought that it would really be a good place to start to make sure that we are all on the same page and have kind of a foundational understanding of what this is, why systems are moving in this direction, what are some of the concrete practice changes associated with it, before we start talking about implementation and all of those things, potential change projects and all of that other stuff. Does that make sense? Would that work for folks on the whole?
Sounds good.
Yeah.
Okay, great. And I'm going to talk about a little bit about the emergence of recovery and recovery management as an organizing paradigm for addiction services and supports in the field, and characteristics of the ROC and the implications for treatment, some of the frequent concerns, and at any point whatsoever, stop and let's have discussion if you have questions or thoughts or anything like that. So to begin with, some of the historical forces leading to recovery transformation just in the field are around the explosive growth in addiction advocacy groups, federal studies at the national level that have really talked about some of the challenges that currently exist in addiction treatment systems, and also this expanding research base that's emerging that really talks about what are the types of services and support that must promote recovery. One of the things that always comes up when we're talking about any kind of transformational change or change, often people get defensive, anxious, and I think it's important to really acknowledge as we even talk about recovery or systems of care and what they are and why they develop, that treatment as it currently exists works. That treatment actually, we're all in this business because we believe that treatment works. What the challenge is that treatment as it's currently configured really focuses on has a limited focus of attention and intervention. And so if we think about the stages of recovery, people who have not initiated recovery yet, then people who are initiating recovery and getting stabilized in their recovery, and then those who are learning how to maintain and sustain their recovery, and then those who are really building a rich quality of life in the community. Some of the advocates and experts in the field are talking about these four stages of recovery. The current treatment has really focused on recovery initiation and stabilization. People come into treatment and we help them initiate and stabilize their addiction, and often they graduate and they're doing well, but they haven't necessarily learned skills, techniques, supports to help them maintain their recovery over the long haul. So some of the challenges that we're seeing in systems in terms of how people are faring in treatment systems nationally, we're seeing some limited access to services in terms of those who need treatment and the extent to which those who need treatment will access it in their lifetime. We're looking at about 25%, and of those who need it in a year, about 10%. Now, we don't know what percentage of those actually get into recovery through other avenues outside of treatment, but still that's a pretty, 10% in a year is a pretty low number. And then when we look at pre-treatment dropout rates, those rates nationally are exceeding 50%. And lastly, those less than 50% who are, and when I say pre-treatment dropout rates, I'm talking about from the time that a person actually makes contact and saying that they want to initiate services to the time when they actually get connected to services. Between that window, 50% of those individuals actually don't connect and drop out before they get the treatment. So those who do access services, less than 50% of those who are admitted to treatment in the public sector nationally successfully complete. And so some of the other, I think, critical data is around length of service contact, that people aren't staying in care for as long as the 90 days as recommended by NIDA. Obviously, high recidivism, we all know. But one of the critical, I think, pieces of data research that emerged in recent years is really that it takes 4 to 5 years of sustained remission for the risk of relapse to drop below 15%. So 4 to 5 years for people to be in sustained remission, and that's for alcohol recovery, for the risk of relapse to drop below 15%. And for other drugs, it's longer. And so what the research is telling us is that we really need a chronic care model of treatment. But the way that our systems of care are structured right now is really around brief episodes. People come in for, maybe 3 months, get a brief episode of treatment, and they graduate and they're gone. But what the research is telling us, and really what people's lived experience is showing us, that brief episode of treatment is not often enough to help people sustain their recovery over the long term. Does that make sense? So if we think about a chronic care model for addiction services, we're really thinking about an approach to care that tries to connect with people earlier on the front end, so that pre-recovery initiation, before they get into treatment, to going through treatment, and then after treatment, how do we sustain, support, monitor, so that people have the resources that they need to sustain their recovery. So this whole kind of paradigm shift around the development of recovery-oriented systems of care really emerged in the field out of a recovery management approach to treatment, which began to look at how do we develop a chronic care approach, and what would that actually look like? What would we be doing differently? And so some of the things that we know we would be doing differently, for instance, and you guys probably already know them. Anyone on the phone, what are some of the things that we would be doing differently if we had a chronic care approach to treatment as opposed to an acute care model? Anyone?
This is Kevin. I guess those supports that are provided on a longer basis, and then also the utilization for us, I think peer-based services as opposed to just those clinical-based services.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. The longer-term support on the back end, more peer-based support, linking people to more natural support, so knowing that it's not feasible necessarily for somebody to be in treatment for 5 years, given that quota of it takes 4 to 5 years for risk of relapse to drop below, but how can we help people build up a natural support system that can help them to sustain their recovery in their community? So, recovery-oriented systems of care really evolved out of this recognition that current treatment systems are working, but that they have evolved and developed into an acute care model that isn't consistent with what the research tells us people actually need. And so this whole notion of a recovery-oriented system of care lot of, I think, variability in the field about what exactly is that, what does it look like, and I love Bill White's definition. And he says that basically a recovery-oriented system of care is a network of formal and informal services that are developed and mobilized to sustain long-term recovery. And he clarifies that the system in a ROS, ROS is the abbreviation for recovery-oriented system of care, isn't a treatment agency. It's a macro-level organization of a community, a state, or a nation. So no one treatment facility or peer-based organization or, you know, grassroots community organization can be a ROS. And I hear that all the time, particularly among providers saying, we're developing a ROS. And I think that's one of the things that is needed in the field is more understanding of the need for these partnerships, informal and formal networks that come together to really develop a system that supports people. So in terms of concrete practice changes, what's different from in a recovery-oriented system of care versus a traditional system of care, and how does that actually look on the ground? I'm going to talk about it in the context of some of CSAC's elements of a ROS that they have defined. And one of them is they talk about an integrated service approach that really focuses on wellness and a holistic approach. So for me, this is one of the most important things, because in a traditional system of care, when folks come into treatment, they are focused, we as providers, when I was a provider, I was focused on symptom reduction, on helping people stabilize, on helping people, get past whatever challenges might be, whether it was a mental health challenge, an addiction challenge, and really help to stabilize their symptoms. That was kind of the goal. And in addiction, the goal is abstinence, helping people achieve a state where they're substance-free. And in a ROS, I think we started to hear increasingly people saying that just because I have achieved abstinence doesn't mean I'm equipped to live a full, meaningful life in my community. And people started articulating that, and people obviously show us that by relapse, high recidivism. And so in ROS, one of the most critical things is a holistic approach that focuses on wellness beyond symptoms. And the way that this is done is really through, one of the first things is through global assessments that focus not just on, again, what the problems are, but multiple domains in the person's life. And what are their goals relative to all of those domains, whether it be education, employment, housing, relationships, family, whatever it may be. And then also developing as a next step to that kind of global assessment process, a recovery plan that is much more holistic. So A lot of folks who are developing recovery-oriented systems of care are encouraging their providers to transition from developing treatment plans and instead developing recovery plans. And we can talk more about that in another call in terms of how it's different and all the supports that are needed to do that and what it looks like, the impact of that is. But essentially, the recovery plan, the treatment plan is embedded in the broader context. So instead of the goal, again, in most treatment, it's, you know, if you're an IOP, come to group 3 times a week, have individual once a week. And the treatment plan is not highly individualized. In a recovery plan, the focus is really, again, on the person's life, what they want their life to look like, what their hopes and dreams are for their life. And I often hear providers saying to myself, system administrators, we don't get paid to ask people about their dreams. Or we don't get paid if what if somebody says that they want to become a tailor. I don't get paid to help them become a tailor. I get paid to, you know, treat their addiction. And that is true. But what we say is that when you're treating your addiction, you're really looking at why is this important to this person? What is it that you're trying to accomplish in your life and what's getting in the way of that? So although you don't get paid to, you know, help somebody to become a tailor or a baker or whatever the heck their dream might be, we do pay people do get reimbursed for addressing what's getting in the way of that person having a full, meaningful life. And what we found is if treatment isn't focused on that broader context of how does all of this stuff that I'm doing in this treatment setting fit into my broader life, then people find that it is not relevant for them and they are less engaged and they end up leaving. Another thing that, in terms of wellness, holistic approach, is really developing a flexible menu of services and support so that people have choice when they come into a service setting. It's not, this is our program, and you got to work the program. Our job is to create the program. Your job is to work it. And that's how you're going to get into recovery. Instead, the focus is on, really, this is our program, and we've created kind of a flexible menu of services and support so people have choice to create what type of recovery path makes the most sense for them and is most consistent with their desires, their interests, their personality. And that's not often done, unfortunately, in traditional treatment settings. So that's a little bit about how we promote wellness and a holistic approach. Another characteristic of a recovery-oriented system of care is really focusing on assertive outreach and engagement. And I love this quote. It's in one of Bill White's books. And it says it's an outreach worker. And he says, before I say his quote, let me preface this by saying, when I was in training, my background is in clinical psychology. I was initially trained in mental health, working with children and families, and then transitioned into working primarily in addiction with adults. And so I have kind of training and experience on both sides. And on the mental health side, I was typically told, never work harder for your client than they are working for themselves. The client always has to be working, showing you that they are motivated, ready, and they have to be willing to work harder than you are for them. On the addiction side, I was told that sometimes people have to hit bottom, they have to hit rock bottom, and they have to be in enough pain to be motivated enough to want their recovery and to stay engaged in treatment. And this quote by Bill, or in Bill's book, an outreach worker says, my clients don't hit bottom. They live on the bottom. If you wait for them to hit bottom, they will die. The obstacle to their engagement in treatment is not an absence of pain. It is an absence of hope. And I love that quote because it really, I think, captures so just cutting to the core that it's really not about people being motivated enough for treatment. It's about how do we increase their hope so that they stay engaged in the process. And the research actually shows us, research that was done in the 90s and in around 2006, shows us that those who are least likely to stay engaged in treatment aren't those who one of the least, but they are the people who actually have the most complex and severe problems and the least recovery capital and support, the most severely disrupted lives to help them stay connected and initiate their recovery. So given that in Iraq, we're looking at, instead of readiness being an all or nothing thing, that you are ready for treatment or you're not, or we can work with you and we'll engage successfully when you're motivated enough. In Iraq, there's a recognition that recovery support and services need to be offered on a continuum, because people are in different stages of their recovery, of their motivation, of their interest. And so how do we engage people who are early in the process? And again, looking at folks who may not be ready for treatment, how do we even engage them? And so one of the things is really around, rather than waiting for people to come to us and be ready for treatment, which means that they usually come at later stages in problem development when under coercion from the criminal justice system or child welfare system, and when they come in later stages of problem development, they have, unfortunately, worse outcomes in treatment. So how do we get them earlier, at earlier stages in problem development? And that's through assertive outreach, getting out into the community or partnering with grassroots organizations that have connections with people, and looking at innovative, creative ways where we can actually engage people in the treatment process. And that may start with pre-treatment supports that are just aimed at, that might mean, you know, attention to basic needs. That may mean helping people with housing, transportation, or addressing family concerns, or whatever that person is presenting with as a concern to them. How do we engage them and build a relationship with them at that point and increase their motivation to engage through the relationship that we build? So in Iraq, essentially, motivation isn't seen as a prerequisite of treatment. It's really seen as an outcome of the service relationship. So that assertive engagement and outreach is a critical component. We're also looking at, everybody knows, peer support is a huge part of a recovery-oriented system of care. And that is demonstrated or operationalized in different ways, sometimes through paid recovery coaches, sometimes through volunteers, sometimes through both. I think that most people's suggestions is that you have a mix of both paid formal peer support and informal volunteer paid support. And I just have experience upon experience of providers who talk about the extent to which integrating peer support in their service mix completely transforms not only the culture of their service, of their organization, but also improved outcomes. And so I know some providers in Philadelphia and Detroit who tried to strategically focus their NITEC project around recovery-oriented services and support. And one provider in particular that I'm thinking of, Northeast Treatment Center in Philly, they looked at just including peer support, increasing peer support through recovery coaches, and they talked about one of their challenges in their setting was really around retention, that their retention rate hovered at a little under 50%. And after including Recovery really had a leadership role in terms of the types of services that were delivered. People in recovery on the leadership council actually did outreach when someone did not show up to group, for instance, for the first, second time. These folks who were serving really as volunteers took it upon themselves to go out into the community, reconnect with them, re-engage them, get them connected back to treatment. And they developed a within the organization, a recovery resource center that was staffed by people in recovery, again, primarily on a volunteer basis. And they said that as a result of doing some of the things and some concrete, some also really specific changes that they made, they saw their retention rate go from a little below 50% to up to almost 80%. That was a while ago that I talked to them. And they also talked about the change in terms of the culture of the organization, that the frontline staff were re-energized, had hope. People talked about, frontline staff talked about all the things that I used to just be able to write down on paper in terms of saying, you know, Robert needs X, Y, and Z in the community. There was a person in recovery who could actually walk with him into the community and help to create those linkages and get things going. So in terms of peer support, I've seen resource centers, as I said, leadership councils, people in recovery doing recovery checkups after treatment and helping people get re-engaged early in the process if they develop a problem with relapse, just companionship and modeling a recovery lifestyle. People in recovery who are leading support groups within programs and helping people get integrated into a culture of recovery again. So as opposed to that addiction culture, which has a really strong pull, helping people create for themselves a recovery culture within the context of their natural community. And one of the challenges that comes up around this issue of peer support and recovery coaches is just sometimes the challenges or conflicts that can arise between counselors and recovery coaches. If there's not enough delineation around roles and boundaries and who's doing what, really needs to be kind of careful attention paid to preparing the setting before just bringing recovery coaches into either a system or an organization. Any questions so far?
Just a comment, going back to the comprehensive assessment and looking at the whole person and all their needs and goals. There's tools that a lot of providers use, like the ASI and the GEAN, that are very comprehensive. Denny Carice did a study a few years ago finding that while providers may do a comprehensive assessment, all they focus on afterwards is the treatment, even though...
That is so true.
Can I ask...
I was trained to ask the questions, but I wasn't necessarily trained to figure out how to integrate the answers to those questions into the process going forward. So I think that's such a great point.
Yeah, and what Denny found was that providers didn't know how to access other resources, how to meet those needs. So it wasn't even that they totally only want to focus on addiction treatment, they didn't know what else to do.
Yeah, and sometimes I think folks are overwhelmed, overburdened, and I think that is where having the peer support can help to relieve some of that if people are trained in how to access other supports and services, systems in the community.
Totally agree. May I ask who's presenting? I'm sorry, I joined a couple minutes late.
Sorry, this is Ijama Achana.
Oh, Ijama, it's Mike Boyle.
Oh, Mike. Hi.
Okay. Cool.
I was actually going to talk about your, could you tell the story about your, sorry everybody, we're just having a moment. could you tell everybody about your recent survey that you did in your organization and what the response was from your staff about what they would want reinstated if they could get anything reinstated?
Oh, yeah, I'll just be very brief. A year ago, every year in Illinois we lose tons of addiction treatment resources, and 2 years ago they cut us about 50%. So as we were working to restore the funding, and we had cut a lot of different outpatient services particularly, I sent an email out to all our staff saying, if we could add back services or add new services, what would you want? And virtually every single response I received was bring back recovery coaching, which we eliminated.
Yeah.
Everybody.
I just think that's so powerful, because oftentimes when I'm having initial conversations with clinicians, counselors, about recovery coaches, as I said, there's sometimes there's some anxiety about what would it be for my role, et cetera, et cetera. But what I've seen is when recovery coaches, peer support gets integrated into the organization, people feel so much more supported. People feel that their jobs are easier, and the outcomes for people receiving services are just tremendous. So I'm glad that you were on the call and able to give us that concrete example. Any other thoughts, questions about anything thus far?
So this is Neil in Georgia. In talking about the peer support, Georgia's been on this cutting edge of the mental health peer support program, and it's been around for about 10 years, and we're starting a certification program for addiction peer support to really come, it is a paid service, and we've actually gotten it Medicaid. It's Medicaid reimbursable too. So all of that's really exciting, but I know that some places are going with more of a volunteer model. I didn't know if there's a place for all of it, actually. And I didn't know if there's anybody on the call or if you have any feelings about paid versus non-paid recovery peer support.
My personal preference, and then I think if I just could share their experience or thoughts, my personal preference, I agree with you, Neil. I think that there's a place for just a diversity of roles for people in recovery in systems. I think that some of the things, in order to really maximize peer support, I think that it's really helpful to have people in formally paid, whatever you want to call them, recovery coach roles, so that you have access to their services and experience when you need it. One provider that I was working with in Philadelphia had people in recovery who were volunteering, but she said that it was really difficult to get the consistency that she needed, because folks who were volunteering were also oftentimes looking for work or had competing demands. And so if she had somebody who needed support at a particular point in time, maybe somebody who's come in and needs to be engaged, needs someone to help to begin to develop a relationship with them, there may or may not be someone around based on the volunteer schedule. And she really found that it was helpful to have a mix of volunteers and people who were staff. And I personally believe that the role of peer recovery coaches is so important that systems communicate that it's valued and that it is important by making it a paid role just like any other role. But I also think that there's a role for folks who want to volunteer, maybe don't want to give as much time, aren't ready to give as much time. There's a whole host of ways that people in volunteer community or people in recovery can be mobilized to do any number of things, and have also seen that, you know, transform organizational cultures and systems, not just organizations.
It's very helpful to talk with you. But I think so too. Sometimes I get pressure from people saying, well, you've got to keep recovery community just tap into that. But I agree, in my experience, it just hasn't been as reliable because it may not be a priority.
Yeah, people have competing demands for their time, just like all of us. And I really think that it's important that when we think about peer support from a systems perspective, that we're not just thinking about peer support, but we're actually thinking about how to develop peer leadership within the system and how to create pathways of opportunity for people. So in Philadelphia, when I used to be the director of strategic planning in Philadelphia, coordinating the system recovery transformation process for about 5 years before I moved to Chicago about a year ago. And when I got to Philadelphia with Dr. Evans, we started doing these community meetings, wanted to get the word out across the city that we were about to engage on this recovery transformation process. And as a part of getting the word out, we brought in national experts, Bill Wright being one of them, to talk about, to really ground this in the national context, in the data, why there was an urgency and a sense of importance about this, and also wanted to bring in the voice of people in recovery who could talk about ways in which services were currently helping them, what they might like to see differently, what else might be helpful, and how services could be more helpful, or how the system could be more helpful. So we started this process of looking for people to participate in these community meetings, in presentations, and over again, it would be the same five people over and over again because they were a part of the advocacy community. They were, many of them, paid advocates, and we couldn't find anyone else outside of the advocacy group. And began to think of a process, really not strategically, but just over time it evolved, of how do you mobilize the recovery community in a city. And it started with, we developed a Recovery for Foundations training, which included people in recovery, providers, frontline staff, executive level staff, and staff, system administrators, staff in the city office, staff in the managed care company, family members, and as a part of those trainings, it was a two-day training to begin to get everybody oriented to this is what a recovery-oriented system might look like in Philadelphia, begin to get a shared vision. We started to have panels of people in recovery in the context of those trainings share their stories. And as people came to the trainings, asking if they would share their stories, at a future training, people started saying, we love doing this, we want more opportunities, and we want more support around sharing our stories. So we developed a storytelling training, which at this point, probably over 1,000 people have gone through the storytelling training now. And within the course of a few years, we went from, I can't find 5 to 10 people to about 3 years later having, I coordinated a recovery conference that was planned by people in recovery, for people in recovery, that was really just having kind of my staff and I support them, do all the logistical, find the space, but they were responsible for the content and everything, and my goal was 700 people. And folks thought I was, I had lost it, that I was going to get 700 people at this conference. And long story short, the day of the conference, we had 1,600 people in recovery in the city. Hundreds of people had to be turned away. And it was really through mobilizing and community people in recovery, which started with storytelling training, which started to spread in the system. And people in recovery said, we want to get out into the community and start telling people about this recovery transformation. So they started going out into libraries, schools, agencies, different places in the community, and started sharing their, not only their recovery story, but they called it taking recovery to the streets, and talking to people about the recovery transformation. The system also developed a leadership academy, which we partnered with a partnership between the city's Department of Behavioral Health and a community college to and create an opportunity for people in recovery to get college credit. And as a result of that, a lot of people got employed. We developed the Peer Specialist Initiative. And it was just a snowball effect. But what many people say is that those activities changed their life, that they actually, every time I go back to Philadelphia, I meet somebody who says, oh, I went to the storytelling training, or I went to the Recovery Foundation training, and from there, somebody saw me, I did a presentation, someone saw me, I got hired to do this, or I started volunteering to do that, and then someone hired me to do blah, blah, blah. And we were just, I was just talking with Dr. Evans last week about tracking all of the folks who went through storytelling training to find out where they are now, because the system is completely, the face of the system completely changed, because it's no longer kind of this transformation process that's driven top down. It's really also people in recovery who are pushing this forward. So I get a little bit passionate about that.
Oh, that's wonderful, thank you.
Any other thoughts or questions, comments about kind of peer support, recovery coaches, or anything else you spoke about? I think from a system perspective, for me, my take home is it's really important not just to think about how to create and expand peer support, but how to create pathways of opportunity for people, so that these opportunities that you're creating can help people rebuild their lives, move on to the next opportunity. And one person in recovery said that they were concerned with that initially they were concerned that they could only ever be a recovery coach, because there would be no other opportunity. Where they saw their colleagues having opportunities for promotion or moving into this role, that role, they didn't see similar pathways for themselves. And I think that's one of the nice things that I see about having volunteers and former paid staff. It, again, creates kind of multiple opportunities for folks.
And that's been traditionally one of the complaints on our mental health care specialists, is that they kind of map it out career-wise and pay-wise. So,
yes.
One of the things that we've done here that I think is really good is that in the contact that any provider has with the state, they have to hire a mental health care specialist. If it means a core service package that we call it, your basic for outpatient services. So, the new FSA is willing to put that in contact for addiction providers too. So really, I think that's a real sign of leadership.
Yeah, and it's huge.
Yeah, there's just one way to institutionalize the whole process.
Absolutely. Another kind of core element of a recovery oriented system of care is really looking at community integration, community inclusion. I remember one of my first addiction programs that I worked in, and I was all hyped up about you know, I'm going to provide holistic services and living Jesus, focus on wellness. And I got this great idea that there was a gym down the road, and I was going to go and ask them to donate equipment to our treatment organization, because then we could, you know, find space for a mini gym, and people could focus on their health. And you know, I go Tracy and ask them, to, you know, who we are and what we're doing, and can you help the community, and what equipment we can donate, and they said no, and I got bummed, and then someone said to me, you know, Jama, the gym is like 2 blocks away. Rather than trying to bring the equipment there, why don't you, like, these people just want to go to the gym, where everybody else goes? And sometimes I think in systems, we can create many communities within the treatment system, rather than, again, creating pathways to help people get integrated into the existing community. And so that was one of the lessons that I learned, was really around how do we partner with the existing natural resources that are around us every day and begin to maximize those. And I know that some of you are already doing this, probably many. I know Kevin in Iowa with APR and the whole network of formal and informal services and support, and really integrating grassroots communities with the treatment setting. But that's a huge focus there. So when we think about community integration, for me it's important because in my mind, people don't recover in the context of their treatment setting, they recover in the context of their community. And so that means that we have to identify what are the opportunities that we can create or strengthen or expand to help people sustain their recovery in the community over the long haul. And there's different strategies kind of at a systems level, at a provider level, at a systems level. Some of the things that that we did in Philadelphia, we developed a faith-based initiative and looked at really, for the first time, partnering with the faith community and figuring out how could we support them in supporting the people that often come to them first before they hit the treatment facility. So again, if you're doing assertive outreach and engagement, how do we partner with the faith community to actually support their outreach engagement efforts, or folks who are recovering in the national context of their faith community, how might we support them, or how do we mobilize the faith community to provide continued sustained support for people after they are transitioning from treatment. And another initiative was bringing together a treatment provider, a grassroots organization, and a faith-based organization, and asking that coalition, community coalition, to identify a challenge within the context of their community, and then kind of do a community mobilization effort to think about, okay, if this is the challenge, how are we going to work together to address that? To address that challenge. And so, for instance, in one community that was primarily an Asian community, the challenge was around many people in the Asian community struggling with both mental health and addiction, but because of the stigma associated with it, with services and with the illnesses, not reaching out for help. And so they partnered with, part of the coalition was a community-based resource center that did everything from tax support to budgeting to a whole bunch of just, you know, basic needs stuff, acupuncture also. And the counselor, I remember the counselor telling me that people would be out in the waiting room, and they were coming to see her, but because of the stigma associated with behavioral health challenges, one person would ask another person, why are you here, or who are you here to see? I'm here for tax support. Who are you here to see? I'm here for taxes also. But they're both there to see, you know, the behavioral health counselor. But because it was in the context, which is a natural community setting, it made it less threatening to be able to access services. So when I think about community health and wellness, I think about how do we mobilize and partner with and integrate all those natural supports that already exist in the community and help them become a part of this whole transformation process. I think Mike Boyle and who's on the phone and Bill Wright helped to pioneer a recovery management approach to treating addiction as a chronic illness. And when you think about that approach, there are really implications at all levels of across many domains of different functions within a treatment setting or system. In terms of attraction, looking to treatment services, people don't naturally kind of voluntarily attract a high proportion of people just to come to treatment. As I said, initially we're looking at 10% in a year. So in terms of attraction, the implications of a loss for attraction are more assertive outreach, engagement. How do we attract people to come and get connected to treatment services? If we're looking at assessment and treatment planning, I talk about more holistic, global, not just a one-time approach to assessment. Typically, you come in, you get an intake, you get your assessment, you do the treatment plan, folks go to treatment, you're never like reassessed. But if we're looking at really stages of recovery, if we're looking at stages of change, if we're doing an individualized, flexible approach, then the implication is that our assessment is not a one-time activity, but it's an ongoing activity. What might have changed in this person's life or in terms of their goals, and based on that, how does the service make me to change? We're also looking at the composition of the service team being different, not just including professional support and people in recovery, but potentially even folks in the community. For instance, if people are transitioning out of treatment back into the community, typically the way that I was trained was maybe a few weeks ahead of time, we start thinking about discharge, getting a discharge plan together. But in a recovery oriented system of care, my dream is that we would start thinking about that from day one. So at some point, this person is going to be not as closely connected with our treatment setting. And based on that knowledge, what if we were asking questions like, you know, week one, week two, who are your supports in your life, in your community? Or who would you like your supports to be? And if it's the, you know, woman at the corner grocery store, or their barber, or their pastor, or whoever it might be, finding out if it would be helpful for those folks to play a role in beginning to develop this recovery plan. And people are integrated in the process early on so that there's not this big transition from treatment to community on my own. But that support system has already been developed and is already attuned to what kinds of support an individual might need as they go through this vulnerable period of transitioning out of treatment. Um, tells us that it's the first 90 days following treatment in which people are most vulnerable to relapse. So during that time, people are really hanging in a very fragile balance of, moving into sustained recovery and relapsing, and the extent to which we're able to mobilize natural supports in their community and their family to help build recovery capital and push them towards sustained recovery. But in traditional systems, that really hasn't been as strongly our focus, I don't think. And maybe from your perspective, it's different. So one of the things that's different, one of the things that's concerning to folks, and I would just close with this, is that people say, to do all of this, we need money. We need an influx of resources. And I think the exciting thing is, and the exciting thing that NIDTech brings to this, is that there are lots of cross-mutual strategies, small changes that you can make that don't require an influx of new resources. Doing more holistic assessments and integrating them into the treatment planning process, beginning to do recovery planning, potentially utilizing ways to do recovery checkups so that during that vulnerable, critical period following treatment, people have access to some ongoing support and monitoring. Providing people with more of a menu of services and supports rather than a one-size-fits-all approach. So these are just examples, and finally, when people think about recovery transformation, they typically think about treatment, and then we're going to add community-based support, peer support, recovery homes, all this other stuff, and create linkages with the existing treatment system, and then we have a network that is a recovery-oriented system of peer. And what I hope I've been able to outline for you today is that it's much more than the network. The network is extremely important, and having access to those linkages create more of a holistic system is incredibly important. But it's also critically important to align with context of treatment with the shifting paradigm. So it changes at multiple levels of the system and multiple parts of the system. We don't need to talk so much. I think we have 2 minutes for discussion. Fourth question.
Well, just to support your last point, let's do less treatment and more recovery support.
Yes. Absolutely. And others? Is this consistent with how you were thinking about a recovery-oriented system of care? Hello?
Hi, Thomas. This is Kevin. We're coming from. Something that continues to resonate for me is something that I heard a long time ago is, the whole argument of discovery versus recovery. And, treatment does entail a lot of discovery, but, when it comes to putting those things you learn in motion, that's where recovery in the community comes into place, and that's where I really think that our efforts need to be focusing.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Hey, everyone. I hate to butt in. This is Jean, but someone actually needs to use this line since 3 o'clock, so we have to go, but we are going to have this call again next week so we can continue the discussion, okay?
And if anybody wants to email kind of focus areas where you want to drill down more for the next call,